that he will be coming to do a special summer colloquium for this class. Autumn saw him speak, Elvin Ikoku, he's a MD, Nigerian, I believe, who's a PhD candidate at Columbia in humanities and narrative. He was scheduled to come speak in conjunction with Lance's spring class on narrative ethics, but it was that one massive snowstorm where the city sort of shut down for a couple days, and we just couldn't reschedule. And I knew he had sort of international focus coupled with the narrative, so it actually worked out really, I think, quite well that we're able to bring in somebody who is an MD and a humanities type scholar who can bring a narrative perspective to international questions of health and healthcare and health access and equity and all these sorts of things. So he's chosen a story, Richard Seltzer's, what is it, Imelda, which I haven't read. It's a 12-page short story. He tried to send me the PDF, but it just never came through, so I'm tracking down the book to just make my own copy. And I'll email the PDF to you, and I'll have it available for all the MBE students. We'll be meeting in the big room. So instead of having class that day, that will be our class. And you're more than welcome to use that as a topic for your final presentation as well. If there's something about narrative ethics, about narrative that really grabs you, you could do, you know, do a paper about other narrative stories. You know, there's got to be, well, I'm saying there's got to be, there's most likely are many patient stories or practitioner stories or, you know, relief care worker stories that you could talk about. I just thought it would be a nice third dimension because we've read sort of clinical case studies from medical journals. We've read a lot of social science and anthropological type literature, and this will be another data source for understanding global bioethics and global health. So he's confirmed for the third. Yeah, looking ahead. You know, today we're finishing. Hopefully, everyone got my email and could sort of bring their minds back a little bit to last week, because I didn't want to ignore that article, "The Cycling Overseas," and I understand that a lot of people in here took reproductive ethics last semester, and that there was a chunk of time spent on international surrogacy. So that'll be good to bring to the conversation. And then we're really going to focus on just one aspect of the pharmaceuticals. We're going to focus on clinical research, international clinical research. Next week, we will sort of get more into the Whitmarsh article, which talks about sort of pharmaceuticals, you know, more in situ of a culture, and the vaccines. And then I think we can do both of those next week quite nicely. Okay. Tape recorder's on. All right. To get us started in this conversation again, let's just start with, you know, new reproductive technologies. What are we talking about when we talk about new reproductive technologies? Just very simply, you know.
IVF.
There's IVF, sure. There's surrogacy. Mm-hmm.
Along with IVF, PGD, which is pre-implantation genetic testing or
diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And for people who don't know, can you explain what that is?
It's the fact that you can do gene sequencing of an embryo, usually part of IVF. So, you know, they do that as part of picking the best embryo, but also with the advent of all sorts of genetic testing, it's the potential to kind of engineer your child.
What do you mean by best embryo?
That's the gray area. A lot of the time it's, you know, which is most likely to, like, actually produce offspring, you know, which is
right, the most viable.
But then mm-hmm. it opens the door with the, you know, like, do I want a girl or a boy? Do I want a deaf child? Do I not mm-hmm. want a deaf child? And starting to speak for those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, because as is traditionally talked about, best means viable.
Yeah.
And it's now people are talking about other ways. Right, so let's take those as the big three. IVF, surrogacy, and PGD, D, or whatever the abbreviation is. Ethically, when people talk about the ethics of new reproductive technologies, in the U.S., not in a global context, what are some of the issues that you talked about in reproductive ethics that you hear about in the news? What are the sort of the common go-to ethics of reproductive technologies? Yeah.
Sort of beating the biological clock, enabling women in particular to conceive beyond what they might naturally, like the age that they might naturally conceive.
Mm-hmm. And sort of when ethicists talk about that, what is their concern? What's the concern with a, what was it? Oldest, Art Kaplan wrote a column on it. How old was she? Had a baby?
I have no idea.
63, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I know in particular, this might be too specific, that for both men and women, as they get older, the risk for autism goes up when they have children. I know that's probably too specific, but
no,
maybe
we're
just generally like any kind of problem like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the access to IVF from a cost standpoint, like fair. But, you know, right now, it's pretty expensive, so a lot of...
Right, and when you couple access with PGD, you get talk of developing a, you know, you talk of eugenics again. Yeah, Jasmine?
Just the idea of being able to engineer your baby, you know, playing God. I want a child with the blue eyes, blonde hair, you know, boy, girl. Mm-hmm. I hear that a lot.
Is there a distinction between physical traits and disease susceptibility?
I mean, something that comes in with respect to like what's acceptable to select for. Is it okay to select for disease, or is it where do you draw the line?
There's some people that are arguing that it would be beneficial to select against Huntington's,
Does anybody know, last time I looked it up, it was a couple years ago, current state of U.S. regulations about PGD and disease susceptibility? Like, what are you allowed to select for if you're an IVF clinic?
I want to say the U.S. is one of the places that doesn't have any regulations on what you can select for. I think internationally, gender is one of the few things that comes up. Some places say that you can't, and some places say that you can. But I don't think they really have a standard decision about what you can and can't do right now.
I don't think so either. And I know Great Britain, a few years ago, added BRCA 1 and 2 to their list of things that you could select for. And people were really freaked out by that. That's the breast cancer susceptibility gene. Because our understanding of what those genetic markers mean is changing all the time. I mean, when they were first discovered, it was like, we found it, you know, the gene for breast cancer. And we've learned over the years that it's much more complicated than that. So if you're allowing, by law, something that has a little bit more of slippery edges, then the question becomes, well then, you know, what else could be considered a liability or a disability? There's a huge movement, and Carol Schilling talked about it in her lunchtime talk a couple weeks ago with members of the deaf and hard of hearing community wanting to select for deaf children.
We read an article about a couple in the UK, a deaf couple that
were being taken to court. I feel like we heard both sides, like somewhere it's like you know, is it doing damage to actually select a child with disability versus to choose, actively, like so on that end, like, are you doing damage to the child even now? Like, that's a weird kind of...
Well, people have filed wrongful birth suits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end, like, what does it mean if, like, to the larger disability community, if you're choosing to actively select against a certain trait like that?
Let's go Matt, and then Jamie, and then Shauna.
That just reminded me, like, I read an article recently about, I guess it was a couple who were both blind, who, I guess they were doing some sort of, baby selection technology, but they were ensuring them, so that they were ensuring that they would have a child that could see, only so it could take care of them. mind you. But I mean, that was, I mean, it's sort of different, but it's sort of along the same lines. Like, you know, it's the reverse. Opposed to choosing for being deaf, it's like they're choosing for sight.
Mm-hmm. I'd look it up. Jamie?
There's also a similar push for families of little people that are afflicted with dwarfism that have a similar desire to have genetically similar children.
Mm-hmm. And Shauna, what?
Yeah, I was just going to say generally, it sort of goes right into disability studies and ethics and, you know, what is a disability in terms of definition and in terms of, you know, what that community, if you want to call it community, thinks. Because I know a lot of deaf people don't consider themselves disabled at all.
Right.
So then selecting for a deaf baby is not actually hurting the child to them. So there's so many different perspectives on that.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. I guess to your point about dwarfism, I think that's really complicated by the fact that a lot of times if you're homozygous for a certain gene, then you will die before you proceed past infancy. But if you're heterozygous, then you're just a normal dwarf, so to speak. I don't actually know what the correct, term is. But then it just kind of complicates this pre-implantation genetic diagnosis because,
So they both come with the phenotype, but only one leads to pathology from it? Both of them lead to short stature, but only one, the homozygous, leads to, you know, pathologies and as a result of that?
I think both lead to pathologies eventually, but I mean, I think dwarfism, you have a lot of complications in adulthood, but if you're homozygous, you don't live to be an adult. So, I mean, I feel really uncomfortable because I know that there's a better term than dwarf, but the dwarfs that we see are all heterozygous. So I know that pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is used a lot in
just
normal pregnancies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sorry, not
pre-implantation,
but just
amniocentesis.
Okay.
Andy? I'm trying to understand why this makes us uncomfortable. It's playing God. We're playing God when we give people chemotherapy, or when we take off limbs or give people prostheses. So they can walk. I find that it makes me uncomfortable to think you can pick out all sorts of characteristics, but I'm not sure how that's any more playing God than treating dread diseases or the common cold.
I think because let's say with autism, if you're specifically discarding embryos that have autism, what does it say about the people with autism that are already here that you've discarded those embryos? So you're making a judgment call about what a life worth living. And then I think another thing that we brought up is all research that's being done to solve this. I mean, if you're taking that community, it's almost like you're weeding them out.
But by
the families that are here with that funding don't have that, you know, I don't know.
By choosing anything, you are by definition weeding out others.
Something else,
yes.
Right.
But then it's any personal choice. Like, I mean, if you're talking about prosthetic limbs or treating people who are currently alive with the condition, they are in part an agent in that choice, or hopefully, or, well, I guess not always, but.
Not always for children, embryonic surgery.
Right. Children, and parents decide so many things for their children, how they want to raise them and what they want them to, be involved in, all that kind of stuff.
Sure, but I think that's different than discarding embryos. I mean, are we saying that there's no difference there?
I'm trying to understand.
I kind of agree.
Why playing God is unethical in certain circumstances, but not others.
Well, I think it's unethical when you have families who have access to this kind of stuff because of the money, and then they genetically engineer their perfect child who's smarter, who runs faster, who.
It's
GAPCA.
But only in the U.S. do we have access to certain medications. As a result of wealth.
And only certain people in the U.S. have access to prostheses, prosthetic limbs.
Correct.
And cancer treatments.
Correct.
And better, if you take it even one step further, only certain people have access to private schools and stuff like that that make their children smarter and run faster and stuff like
Get
that.
Get them into the right fraternities of people. I think your question is a good one, and it's going to come up, and it comes up in the whoever the author was, Whitmarsh, the Cycling Overseas article, is that there something, because the one key difference is one deals with the process of reproduction and literally of the creation of a life, you know, as opposed to fixing a life that's already here. Because when I talk and I think about, you know, genetically engineering new babies, my sort of gut reaction, unencumbered by theory, is just, what about the natural wonder of life? Which, you know, sounds hokey to talk about it, you know, because it's so not theoretical. I mean, you could probably craft a very nice theoretical argument around it. But there's that gut of, there's something different about this. And that's, I think, what is important to be teased out, what it is. Some people may say it's, you know, the agency of the person doing. You know, yes, we all talk about agency over our children, even if it's embryonic, you know, or prenatal surgery. But when you're talking, and I don't have a problem with discarding embryos, so that's not my issue. You know, not that I'm willy-nilly discarding embryos right and left, but that is not an issue for me that is personally of concern. So is there something, does it then reach farther to sort of not just the nature of the actions that we do, are we physicians, are we this, are we that, or the other thing, but sort of does it get us to the nature of what it means to be human, the nature of the ability to reproduce? We'll talk in a couple minutes about, in the global context, about the commodification of a human body. Perhaps there's something there, that it's getting us too close, it's moving humanness into a market realm. Because we're talking about who has access, who can afford it, what does it mean? That's where I think I don't have a complete well-formulated answer, but I think it has something to do with the commodification and the sort of medicalization of the process.
You could go back as far as just testing the genetic testing for Tay-Sachs, and you'll just say to a couple, you should not have children because you're both positive, or then that's about as benign as you're going to get in terms of genetic engineering. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't offend anybody, I think.
Right.
Tell people that they can't have children?
No, that they shouldn't. That if you decide to have children, you have a one chance in four or whatever of having a child with Tay-Sachs. Therefore, I will decide to adopt. Or one chance in two. I don't know what the genetic probabilities are, but that's a form of genetic engineering.
Okay.
And interfering with the natural magical process of reproduction. But I don't think anybody's offended by it, and I just think it's a matter of each step you take.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of intervention, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Well, this kind of plays into that then too, because I think it's also a question of enhancement versus treatment, and I think that the playing God gets complicated when it's something where it's like enhancing what you would describe as enhancing a potential offspring versus like treating something that could be, you know, problematic, and that's how it also kind of gets layered in with the idea of, okay, well, fixing someone who's already here, or, you know, enhancing something that's going to be, and that's the concept of enhancement versus treatment, and how that makes us a little uncomfortable, I think.
That's true. Good point.
I also think beyond the level of individual selection for traits, on a community level, there's already proof that we can't do this responsibly yet. In India, there are states that have mounting disparities between the number of male children and female children, and it's creating social and reproductive chaos or whatever, or discord anyhow. So we might need at least some regulations before we get step forward.
All good points. And we're just going to complicate them even more by putting them in a global context. We talked about access. Nobody mentioned the Octomom. You know, sort of. I hate my children, they disgust me. too many gossip blogs.
Did she say that?
But then she said she didn't actually say that. But yeah, she said she spends hours in the bathroom crying. Which I would too. And I think every parent could probably say at one point or another that their children are driving them absolutely insane and are disgusting little creatures. But we just don't say that. To a reporter.
So,
just spent a weekend with some friends. Trying to travel with a two-year-old is hard. You don't get any sleep. And they're annoying. And they scream. Gender trait selection we talked about. There's also the question of sort of paternity-maternity. If you're talking about surrogacy with a donated egg and dad's sperm, you got potentially three moms, one dad. So there's a whole, there's sort of the ethical and legal issues of who has rights. It's one of the people we talked about a couple weeks ago who said they went overseas because the Indian surrogate, or is this something just I want? Did we talk about this? That the Indian surrogate mother, it's written into sort of the law that they have no rights. Once that baby is born, it's a handover, bump, done, the end. Whereas in the United States, sort of the surrogates end up having, for, I don't know if it's for a particular period of time or what, but sort of a right of refusal to comply with the arrangement. Very similar sort of issues with adoption. We see this with sperm donation, people trying to track down their biological parents. So you also get, in terms of reproductive technologies, issues of identity. Who am I? What does my genetic background mean to me versus my family background versus the stories that my family has told myself? Sort of the power of genetic information. People mention Gattaca, and part of me thinks, oh, that's just, it's an extreme science fiction movie, but, if you want to have sort of cases where you're sort of saying, I need a guarantee, or sort of a money-back guarantee that my child will be born sighted or short or whichever case it was, you could see if someone's selecting for traits for speed, good tennis ability, and then that person doesn't like tennis, parental expectations of their children. How do you live up to that? If you've been genetically engineered to be perfect, and that was the Jude Law character in Gattaca. He was genetically engineered to be perfect, and he only ever got the silver medal. And it destroyed his life. So there is, obviously, reproductive ethics is bread and butter within bioethics proper. And this is just a very brief spewing of an overview. So what happens when we put it in a global context? Our article for last week talked about the problem of bio-crossings. So that, if you want to look at new reproductive technologies in just a U.S. context, they're still, I think she would argue, bio-crossings. They're breaches of human thresholds. If you want to say a natural human threshold is man and woman's sexual intercourse results in a baby, in any way, shape, or form that you're altering that basic formula, you're sort of breaching sort of the human thresholds. Perhaps ethical thresholds, sort of transhumanism, scientific thresholds. We didn't talk about this, but people have said, what about all the experimentation that has to happen before you get this right? But when you put it in a global context, you also then add transnational and cultural thresholds. And she refers to the marketing of bioavailability. What does she mean by that? What are we talking about? What do you think she means? The marketing of bioavailability. And why is it something that she deems worthy of being talked about?
Maybe like just this idea of, painting the picture that this is where we want to go. Just getting people used to the idea that like there will be a large market of kidneys available in the future. Or just like, I'm thinking of the term very literally, just like what resources are,
available and how new ones will emerge, what mm-hmm. that looks like.
Sure. I mean, if you're going to look at human bodies, whether as organ suppliers or as surrogates or as egg donors or whatever, as a natural resource, that's bioavailability. And anybody that studied sort of the history of sort of markets and natural resources, you know how that story plays out. Resource-rich countries exploit the natural resources of sort of capital-rich countries exploit the natural resources of capital-poor countries. Whether it be stripping rubber trees, agricultural products, and now what they're saying is sort of people, is that there is a large group of bodies that are available to enter into market transactions. That is less talked about in the United States. I mean, we talk a little bit about, you know, the ads on college campuses for, you know, young egg donors of a particular, with particular SAT scores and particular eye and hair color, as sort of a, you know, a hierarchy of bodies. But when you put it into a global context and you talk about global distributions of resources and power and money, I do like her that phrase, the marketing of bioavailability. And it gets to where she really wants to talk about this as a commodification of reproductive bodies. And that's, I think, where a lot of the this is different type responses come from. And it's sort of a highfalutin phrase, that reducing the nurturing affective labor of reproduction to exchange value. Anybody want to translate that into just sort of common everyday parlance?
It's not the natural, loving exchange that we have. There's none of that emotion. It becomes a trade of goods and services mm-hmm. without any humanity. Mm-hmm. Involved.
Exactly. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's taking away the wonder of life, the miracle of life, and replacing it with a straightforward commercial disaffective, unaffective, is that a term? Yeah.
Maybe now, maybe because it's new to mm-hmm. us, but to our grandparents, things we do are not the miracle of life. And they're strange to our grandparents. That's not the way they did it. But maybe our grandchildren will be commonplace and it will be a wonder and miracle, a certain way of handling things. So, when I take my two little kids to church on Sunday, I'm looked at, and I'm alone with two little kids in church, because I'm just, you know, a single dad with two little kids.
What do you mean you're looked at?
Because I'm a single dad with two little kids in church, and that's just not the norm.
Oh.
Where's your wife? Mm-hmm. So, by the old people. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, maybe this will be commonplace someday. I think it's just me.
Do you ever just want to freak him out and say,
yeah.
I'm gay and my partner died?
No.
I'm a gay widow.
No, people say, are they twins? And I say, no. And I go, but their moms look alike too. They are. But that's what they yeah, I think it's just, it'll be commonplace. I think it's just new. And it'll change as it gets more into the culture.
And for people who, the slippery slope type people, that's, I think, their fear. Is that once you take one little step and it becomes right. normalized, then you take the next little step and that becomes normalized.
Okay.
And then pretty soon you have a super race of, you know, tall Nordic fast runners. You know, good at math. I don't know.
But can you make the argument, I mean, that you're giving the miracle of life to somebody that couldn't have a baby on her own side? I mean, for whatever reason. So you're actually, it's still a commodity because she has to go somewhere, say, to India to get a surrogacy, mm-hmm. you know, get a surrogate for whatever reason. But otherwise she wouldn't even be able to experience that. I mean, I think that could be.
So is it a right? I'm not necessarily
saying
right.
It's a right, but I think it's, I don't think it's not devoid of emotional attachment, necessarily.
Okay, let's go with this for a while.
Hmm. I have trouble, because I think, okay, well, if it's not a right, then it's a privilege. But then, if it's a privilege, who is it a privilege to? Only those that can afford it? Is it? Do you then have to have it, does the country where you live have to cover it? How many, what if people don't have health insurance? And, here it's covered only a certain number of cycles, and there's all sorts of regulations, whereas other places it's covered and any number of cycles is covered. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I can't decide where I lie, because it's like, well, okay, I don't know. Is it a right? That kind of irks me.
Wendy.
It's just kind of rising, the way it relates to, of kidneys and stuff in India, too. And how, in one sense, there are a ton of people who need kidneys, and you're doing a service, you're able to donate your own. You're doing a lot of good, potentially, for the person who was on the receiving end of that. But at what cost to people who are giving you their kidney? And I feel like the same way for service, where do you weigh, the balance? You're doing such a service to people who maybe couldn't have children on their own, but then it will come to the women who are, are giving their bodies
And Chelsea and I were talking about this before class, and we were hoping that maybe other people who were in the reproductive ethics class might be able to provide some data. But it seems from just this one article and other things that I read in preparation for last week that, unlike kidney sale, where you sell a kidney and you're 99 times out of 100 worse off than you were before you sold it, the amount of money that's involved in surrogacy actually is turning people's lives around. That they're homeowners, their kids are in school, they've left bad situations, that life, it's, 8 or 9 years worth of salary in 9 months. Does anybody know any sort of data on that, or? Chelsea and Jane, you guys were?
I don't know any specific data, but I know we read a couple articles in that class about, examples of, I think it was actually women in India who were then able to put their kids through school and, that were like, oh yeah, I totally love being a surrogate, it's great, and, they're making enough money, and it's kind of, comparative, we're not, it's cheaper for, people from the U.S. to go to India to get their surrogate, because it's cheaper, but that amount of money for an Indian woman is enough to...
And you haven't taken anything from her, other than 9 months of her life, in the grand scheme of things. She can still have...
It's one of those, at least the way the article was written, she was really thrilled with the process, considering doing it either a second or a third time. So
is the key difference, and then I'll get, is the key difference, because if our problem last week with kidney sales was the exploitative nature of it, if you pay someone enough, does it no longer become exploitative?
I think it was interesting. I was also in that course that most times they would phrase it as they were paying them for their time. They were paying them for what was happening to their bodies. It wasn't specifically commodifying the child. It was the time that they were paying for. Or in foreign countries where it was inappropriate to give a monetary sum, they'd give them a gift, such as a boat or a tent or things like that, something that they saw as comparable to the worth.
Good points.
Yeah.
It could actually be healthier afterwards. Less risk of developing certain cancers after having a baby.
Well, I think most of the articles say that to be a surrogate, you have to have already had your own child.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I missed
that
point.
Because they don't want people to...
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They want to know you can do it.
That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
I was going to say, with kidney cells, it's different, too, because it's not legal, and so there's no regulation in terms of, the poor actually getting paid and being able to benefit, like we saw in the Goyal article. And also, in terms of the risk, the risk of nephrectomy when done right and properly is really minimal, and you can argue that there's a lot to gain from it. So, for the people that are giving the kidney and for the receiver, so...
So have we come around as a group to saying, all right, markets of bodies is fine as long as there is just compensation.
We still like
So if there's still that,
right?
Would it?
Okay, I guess I'm just still confused about the term markets of bodies because I mean, aren't we? I mean, I guess last week we talked a little bit about models and prostitutes, but sorry.
Models, prostitutes, and kidney donors. That would bring people in.
Aren't you marketing, like, I mean, if we're talking about risk, aren't you marketing bodies of, like, test pilots? I'm just throwing that out there as, like, a completely just maybe terrible example, but, like, if you're talking about, like, paying someone for the risk, then I don't know if we... Wouldn't that be considered in part a market for someone's body? Are we talking about the body?
Oh, I see. Like if you talk about risky professions, like oil rig workers, test pilots. Sure, and that goes to your point of it's not you're not buying a baby. You are you are compensating for labor, literally. Mm-hmm. And physically, literally, figuratively.
Yeah, like if they paid, for example, for organ donation, well, not donations, if they paid enough for organs, it could be something that, you know, not just the poor and helpless would end up doing.
Oh, they would.
They might, but maybe more people outside of that sect would end up doing it, and we might be looking at it completely differently.
Like grad students and debt.
Yeah, grad students.
The growing
I don't know,
in poverty middle class.
Like, I don't know.
I mean, look at poor students and egg donation.
Mm-hmm.
I know 5 separate people that have done.
Really?
That's an argument now is saying that people in that Goyal article, okay, that showed exploitation. But if things were to change where you couldn't show that much exploitation, would we say that it's okay?
Well, I think that we are saying that we are, at least in terms of surrogacy, if that results in a woman being able to pay
for her children,
get 8-9 years worth of salary and pay for children's education, then, you know, it makes a lot of sense.
I'd say so too.
I think we're coming back to autonomy and we're coming back full circle to that though.
Thank you, because I had that thought and then it went away, and I was thinking that it comes down to if the classic case of ethics is, well, is someone fully informed of the risk of benefits? How truly informed can someone be when they are in a fundamentally exploitative environment? Which, you know, you can make the argument that a poor grad student is not in the same category as an impoverished woman in a developing country. But you're right, if we, you know, we can't be so quick to just say, okay, well, as long as we pay people enough. Because then the question remains still of, you know, sort of the globalization, which is where we're going to sort of get with clinical trials too, of risk distributions. Jamie,
are we still worried about losing the nurturing affect? Because I'm not convinced by that.
That we're losing. Not convinced.
I'm not convinced that that is something that we need to worry about losing.
Ah.
If that's one of the things that we're taking into consideration.
Well, I mean,
because
you could argue that there's steps of the process that are missing, and those steps would exist naturally otherwise, and there's something maybe inauthentic about it if those pieces are missing.
Right. I my thought was just that, you know, we don't outlaw a non-nurturing environment for a child to be grown up in or to be raised in. We've allowed, you know, families to marry and have children for diplomatic reasons for thousands of years. It feels very naive to say that we're definitely going to be losing some sort of nurturing affect that is always present.
Okay.
As someone who has never given birth or knows nothing about nurturing affect.
You're not lying, are you?
That's Jane, then Shauna.
Well, this wasn't necessarily tied to that, but I think the other problem with, you know, saying that, well, as long as we pay them appropriately, organ donation is comparable to either surrogacy or, like, egg donation, I think there's still a different level of risk, and I think the big problem, I forget was the Boyle article, which kept talking about, you know, the standard of, or quality of life had gone down, and there's all this other treatment and, you know, issues with that, whereas you don't see that necessarily associated with these reproductive technologies where you're doing egg donation or surrogacy. I think the level of risk is drastically different, and I don't know if that's related to the fact that one's much more legal and regulated and one's not, but I think that that's something to consider, where, like, you're, you know, if you're going to donate a kidney, you're going to take into account a lot of different lifestyle changes that are going to go with that, and people, and that's kind of dealing with whether or not people are informed and not really understanding that part of it, maybe, but I think that probably should weigh in whether or not it does, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good point. Shauna?
So this is rather tangential, so I'm sorry, but I'm just always, whenever I think about this stuff, I'm always really bothered by, just in a global sense, why people are not adopting when they can't have babies. It's maybe it's a personal qualm, but I'm so uncomfortable with the fact that they would, and I really like the fact that, you know, a woman can get paid 8 years' salary. I think that that's great, but if you think about it globally, how will a country, like a third world country, ever get out of its extreme poverty if the population is so out of control? And so why, I mean, that's a separate issue, I know, but why, sorry. So why are people spending such large amounts of money, and they still are large, even if it's smaller, rather than adopt? If it's, I mean, you know, they might be using someone else's egg and someone else's body, but they won't adopt.
Adoption's not cheap.
I never said it was cheap, but it's, they're both expensive.
Yes.
Both things are expensive.
I wanted to bring this up really quickly when we were going over ethical issues of NRTs. I was once, it was at Hopkins, and we were doing like a class or an ethics class for a group of OBGYN residents. And we didn't even think of this as an ethical issue, but at the end when we asked them for their comments, they said exactly what you said, which was they deal with so many women who don't want their baby or don't want their pregnancy, and then they're like, we have so much trouble with the NRT, IVF stuff. Like, we don't, it's hard for us to do. So I don't know, it was something that we didn't feel out as ethicists, but they had this, like, internal reaction to doing that.
I think it's an interesting point, but I think if we could, I don't think we can go there today.
Totally fine. I figured. I couldn't keep quiet, sorry.
Yeah, it's fine.
I've blown it all.
But it does bring up the topic. It does bring up the issue, you know, when you realize, you know, that what a privileged position, it kind of points out the U.S. versus the global, and that if we're sitting over here worried about a super race of people because of new reproductive genetic technologies, look at the population distribution around the world.
Yeah.
We're not in any danger of overrunning anybody.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that is a whole other class. But, you know, I wanted to just touch, and then we'll very shortly we'll move on to the pharmaceuticals, but she says in her article on page 370, reproductive tourism carries intimations of hedonism discordant with the anxiety, hope, and pain often associated with these treatments. So the Jamie's point of, you know, I don't know if we really need to be worried about losing anything here. You know, that if you are that desperate for a child, to spend the money, go to India, entrust your egg and sperm to a stranger, there is still quite an effective relationship with the child. You know, you haven't lost that. But it is interesting, you know, and I like her article in that she talks about how these reproductive tourism companies sort of advertise and spin, you know, and talk about how it's really altruistic of these women in foreign countries to do this for us. And a lot of, at one point she says, you know, it really is also, we can think about, just like with transplant, a failure of the healthcare system in the United States that's causing these reproductive, quote unquote, exiles. You know, the problematics with the terms are there, but... And so in a lot of this language that's used targeted to patients is, you know, doctors in the U.S. just think of you as, you know, a womb and a wallet. They don't care about you. We care about you here. So she talks about this process of reproductive normalization. So how, even though it is fundamentally, at its core, I believe, a commercial transaction. You're not, even if we're not talking about buying a part, it's a commercial transaction for labor. The reproductive normalization is de-emphasizing the commodification while, as they say, reasserting the emotional connections. To sort of take whatever it is that's sacred or special or distinctly human about the act, and in trying to normalize this very unnatural, as of now, who knows what it'll be like 20, 30 years from now. But that's something to think about all as we go home tonight, and not necessarily talk about it anymore here, but, you know, I talked about this with my husband, and, you know, to say, I said to him, I said, I would never do PGD. I mean, we did amniocentesis, we did certain tests, but I would never select traits. And he was like, oh, hell yes, I would in a heartbeat. Why not give our children the best advantage that we can? So it's something for each of us to figure out on our own, what it is that if we have that point, and if we don't, I don't know. It's fun to talk about. Given all of this, given that we've sort of said, all right, well, on some level, there are some ethical issues, but perhaps it's, grand scheme of things, not cause for concern in the same way that kidney sale is. Do we think that there, and this was in one of the discussion board postings, do we think there is, and if we do think there is, why is there stigma for traveling overseas, particularly for reproductive care? The article talks about people not talking about it. Why are we not talking about it? Or why are these patients not talking about it? Is it stigma? Is it something else? Is it the stigma of the commercial transaction? Is it the stigma of overseas? Is there less stigma with US-based surrogates?
I think there's like an embarrassment of saying you can't produce your own kids. I think people are just, they don't want to admit that.
Mm-hmm. That it's a fundamental failure as a human being.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd agree that there's some type of shame in infertility that if you have to go to the expense of getting a surrogate or getting IVF or doing things like that, that there's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen.
I agree with that, but I think also that Americans tend to think that we have the best quality of care over here, so why are you going somewhere else where you can get possibly less quality, you know, just not as good? Why would you leave America?
Cheapskate.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's also, you know, has anyone here seen Baby Mama? I searched right and left to find the clip, and I could not find it online, and we don't own the movie here. The scene where Amy Poehler's character comes into the baby shower, and Tina Fey's character basically sort of, you know, you piece of white trash, you're just a womb, you know? And when I saw it in the theaters, and I saw it twice, because I saw it with one person and I wanted to go see it again, both times, I mean, that was the line in the movie where Tina Fey's character rails in a classist way against Amy Poehler's character. Everyone, you know, was like, oh, no, she didn't just do that. You know, like the character of the doorman, who was like, I don't know what he says, but he has something, you didn't deserve that. Nobody deserves that. So I think that's part of, in any thinking about global reproductive ethics, you can't, and that's one of the points of this class, is you can't disassociate the ethical issues from questions of culture, class, religion, ethnicity, all of these things.
I was going to say, and let's be honest, I mean, people are thinking that, like, what I mean by that is people in the audience are like, oh no, but that absolutely, I mean.
Right, because we are so embedded in the culture that we all.
We know it's not good to say those things. It's like, you know.
But we come from such a class of society that we probably are all.
We're thinking it. Of course we're thinking it, you know.
Because like we're embedded in the system too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's that lot, right? Have you ever seen Avenue Q? Like, everyone's a little bit racist.
No, I've always wanted to see that, though.
But, you know.
Really, there's an Everyone's a Little Bit Racist
song? It's a song. Oh, it's great.
Oh, yeah. How funny.
Hilarious, actually.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the things anthropologists will often say, is they say, just because we're cultural relativists doesn't mean we're better than everybody else. It just means we recognize our own biases and we strive very hard not to have them play a role in how we do our research. And if you're a really good anthropologist, then you say, how you live your life. Remind me of another point to tell you when the tape is off of how I fought so hard against some of my classist leanings, and I ended up having my identity stolen by the person that I was trying very hard to not have any negative feelings toward. So, you know, there you go. All right. It is 5:30-ish. I want to spend the next hour on pharma. If there's some still burning question about international surrogacy, paper topic idea perhaps. Okay. Pharma can really be divided, as we're thinking about, into three areas. There's drug development and clinical trials in developing countries. But then there's also, and this is where the Whitmarsh article gets to, sort of the availability of drugs in resource-poor settings, back to where Farmer was talking about. You know, there's a huge role of the international pharmaceuticals play just in the daily access to drugs for treatment and for prevention, these sorts of things. And then there's the special case of vaccines. Those two things we're going to do next week, because there is so much to cover here. So as a start, I just wanted to give a general introduction to the drug research process. And those of you who are taking research ethics this semester or have taken it before, this is a general overview. It's enough to get us going. If there's something that I'm egregiously wrong about, let me know. But I want to break down sort of the phases of research. And there's sort of the preclinical trial phase. And that's sort of the drug discovery. It's what's happening in universities and research institutions. I think I found a molecule that does a certain thing and potentially has a benefit to humans. Average of that phase is 6 years. And again, when I say average, it's like per drug. Then you've got a clinical trial phase, which can average another 7 years. So phase one trials. You've heard some of this, you know, probably in some of the readings. A phase one trial is the first time out from animal studies. So in that 6 year pre-period, you're also doing animal models. You're also doing sort of isolating organs. I'm not sure exactly how that works. If you're using, I have no idea how it would work. I spent one semester in biochemistry. Phase one trials enroll under 100 patients, generally. The point of them is to determine the maximum tolerated dose and likely side effects. In other words, you're determining at what point a drug becomes harmful. You are enrolling normal volunteers, and there your goals are safety and tolerability. First, you're giving people single doses, and then if they tolerate a single dose, you can multiple dose them. Until the drug seems to be having harmful side effects, then you stop. If normal volunteers work well, then you go to sort of mildly symptomatic for whatever it is, whatever problem your drug is designed to address. Same goals. But you're adding an initial sense of efficacy. You know, not just does this have bad side effects, but does it seem to have any, you know, did what we think was going to happen? Does this actually lower cholesterol? Does this actually reduce depression? Does this actually lower certain levels of something or other? So that's your phase one. Nearly 90% of phase one trials are abandoned because they're proven to be unsafe or ineffective. Phase two, you got dosing cohorts. You've discovered that it's safe. You have initial data that shows that it's probably efficacious. You take an initial cohort of people and you give 1/1000th of the dose at which the animal model experienced toxicity. If no toxicity observed, you increase your enrollments and you increase your dose by a power of 10. Until investigators believe that a maximum tolerated dose for humans has been reached. In many respects, phase two trials are proof of concept. You know, so you've gotten enough efficacious indications in phase one to move to a phase two, if you're finding results as you anticipated, yes, levels are going down, yes, this is happening, that's what they mean by proof of concept. Does this drug do what we think it's going to do? It can be single or multi-sites. They're small in general. They're short duration, 6 weeks, just long enough to justify the longer exposure of a phase three trial. And I'll post all these slides. Phase three trials enroll several hundred patients to identify the diseases or stages of disease that are affected by the intervention. It's at this point that you're trying to accumulate evidence to merit your FDA approval. This is where a lot of international clinical trials happen. You've already done the smaller scale, you've proven that it's efficacious, now you just need bodies. So if you're talking about marketing of bioavailability, that plays a role in clinical trials too. We'll talk about that in a minute. These are where you have double-blind, multi-site placebo and active controlled, and we'll talk a little bit, and I'm calling on you, Andy, when we get to this point, we talk about placebos and active control. They can be either. Phase four, this is sort of after you've gotten it approved, after you've marketed, they're post-marketing. And a couple of the articles I read said these phases are designed to support your marketing campaign. I thought, well, that's really cynical. That can't be right. But everyone talks about it in this way. That's just what they are. They're designed to, I think this is probably where the Vioxx problems happened. You know, it had gotten approval, it had been marketed, it had been out there, then they discovered previously unreported side effects, and then it was pulled. So my impression, and I'm not an expert in this, John Merz could talk for hours on this, is that this may be, so there's phase four happening at the same time that is general population. So perhaps a physician who is a clinical coordinator, or you know, who is involved in a trial, can recruit patients, you know, into these sort of phase four. And we'll talk in a little bit. I mean, who wouldn't participate in a phase four trial? It's FDA approved, we're marketing it, we've been given approval. We just need to, you know, do a little bit more sort of study with real patients, see how well this works for you. Over $1 billion to bring a drug to market from that initial molecular discovery, paying researchers, buying research, through to market. And I think I've said this before, it's really hard to figure out why does it cost so much? I found, and if you search Professor Baker, the economics of the pharmaceutical industry, you'll find this PowerPoint. It's some international conference, she posted this. And the numbers meshed well enough with other things, so I've cited it and presented it to you. Of that 1 billion pie, R&D, 14%, profits, 17%, marketing administration, 32%, capital label and materials, almost 40%. Sort of aggregate data from the seven biggest drug companies. You know, again, if you could cut the profits down, cut the marketing administration down. So here's some of your marketing. Advertising to doctors. Same source, I didn't write down where that 7.2 comes from. I have an old high school acquaintance who's now, you know, a Facebook friend, who is a drug rep. And I swear to God, all of his posts are, Jim is checking in at the Crab Shack. Jim is checking in at this restaurant. Jim is checking in at that restaurant. I'm sure he's taking doctors out to lunch every day. No person eats out that much. Drug samples, $16 billion. There's a whole other ethics with drug samples, you know, because Penn now doesn't allow them. You can't even have a pen that says Pfizer on it at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. Direct-to-consumer advertising, which is growing every year. $1.1 billion between those years. Lobbying costs. So lots of money from the pharmaceutical industry to develop, to market, to distribute. However, here's where the global ethics part comes in. It's the 90-10 problem, which you hear about in a lot of articles, is that in 2007, $56 billion was spent by pharmaceutical industries and their, you know, associates. 90% of those, that money was spent for 10% of the disease burden, cardiovascular disease, other sort of, you know, first world diseases, versus where, you know, that's sort of where Farmer's talking about, but he's talking about sort of prevention. Here's sort of the research side of it. And people claim, you know, they say it's a lack of profit motive. You know, there's not a lot of R&D for quote-unquote tropical diseases because there's no profit. What does that mean? Here's what it means. Again, same person's slide. A little hard to see, but here is market share by sales versus percent of the global population in 2007. So if North America has 5% of the global, the world population, we've got 45.5% of the global market share of drug marketing. And you can see Latin America, 9%, 4.8% market. Nobody's doing too much work in Latin America. In Europe, 31% global drug market share, 12% population. They've lumped Africa and Asia together. She's siphoned off Japan and what does that say, Australia? So of global sales of $702 billion, here's where the pharmaceutical money is being spent compared to populations. And here she throws in percentage of global pharmaceutical sales in the poorest regions. And her question is, how important are these tiny markets to R&D incentives? I'm not sure I want to necessarily debate that. Do we have anybody who's worked in the pharmaceutical industry?
I represent a couple of pharmaceutical companies.
Okay.
And I work in the industry that we're for.
Mm-hmm. Because I've had other people in the class who have been global clinical research coordinators, and they get very offended on presentations of this kind of data because on the surface it just makes it seem like they don't care. And she's like, but everybody on the ground cares. You know, she's like, my colleagues care. You know, we are doing the best we can to take care of people in our clinical trials. And I believe that's true. But I also, in the same part of my brain, believe it's true that, you know, global pharmaceuticals have consistently, over the past 10 years, been in the top 5% of profit-earning industries in the world with outrageous profits. So there's a disconnect there between profits for shareholders and profits for companies and the people who are doing the work. So again, I don't necessarily want to debate that, but we can think about it and bring it up at a later point. I want to sort of keep barreling through these so we can get to more conversation about the ethical issues of the distribution of clinical trials. What I just presented was intended to be just sort of a lay of the land of what is involved in a clinical trial, what are the point of the different phases of the clinical trial, where the money's being spent, and where clinical trials are being done, which is where we are now. In 1990, there were 271 overseas clinical trials. 2008, there were 6,485. It's a 2,000% growth rate. In 2008, 80% of new drug applications to the FDA contained data from foreign clinical trials. So we'll talk extensively about the Trovan case in a little while. This kind of thing, using data from foreign trials in new drug applications. While it is true that most clinical trial work is still being done in the US, the UK, Germany, and Australia, if you look at percent growth, they're hosting fewer and fewer trials every year. But the growth rate in China was 47%, Russia 33%, Argentina 27%, India 20%. So if the rate in developed countries' clinical trials is going down, the rate in developing countries is going up. Okay, so I'm going to barrel through the research ethics in the United States, and then I'm going to turn it over to you, and I have everybody blocked off, which is another reason why I love these discussion forums, because you already know what you want to say. And don't leave for too long. You're on the next slide.
Time me.
In the United States, key issues. Of course, research, informed consent. You know, well, okay. Informed consent as a model of how it's done in clinical trial work is based on a very particular model of communication. It's a transmission model of communication. Message sent should equal message received. So success equals assigned consent because that indicates message received. Transmission model of communication doesn't take into account noise. Noise is anything that would cause somebody to have a different understanding of the message from the intended message. Noise is the bread and butter of anthropology. You know, so a huge issue here is the location of the consent and who is consenting. If you're in a clinical trial for a cancer drug, and you're presenting, you know, informed consent for a clinical research trial, this is research. It is not treatment. We are trying to figure out if this drug will do something good for you. We don't know if it can, because you're not really allowed. You're not really supposed to say the last five people we enrolled, they're all still alive. You can't say that when you're enrolling someone in a clinical trial. But you're the mother of a kid with stage 4 cancer being approached by your pediatric oncologist with the opportunity to go to a clinical trial. You're telling me there's no noise? Of course there's noise. There's the noise of hope. And that's what's called the therapeutic misconception, is that patients / subjects, and it's talked about right and left. All of the majority of the research ethics literature, if you're talking about clinical trials, authors will go back and forth between subjects, participants, patients. They're not even keeping it straight themselves. That would be a fascinating study to do, just sort of an analysis of that literature. Just even, you know, simple word searches and how it's talked about. That'd be a good paper. If anybody wants to do a final project for the MB program, I'd write that with you. People often focus on the therapeutic misconception of the patients, that they have too much hope, they're too desperate, they're not hearing the informed consent. And we sort of say, okay, well, we've done the best we can. Pamela Sankar here wrote a great article, if you're interested, I can send it to you, sort of the therapeutic misconception of the physicians and the clinical trial, you know, recruiters, all around this topic of framing. And Daniel, you'll be interested in this based on your, didn't you do a framing presentation in the movies class? This is fascinating. I think we talked about it in this class. She did a study, participant observation, with clinical trial coordinator, or physicians trying to recruit patients. Actually was in the room at the time. Audio recorded it, transcribed it, analyzed how the recruiters and the physicians talked. And she found that a lot of times, for phase one trials, which remember, the purpose of a phase one is to prove that it's safe, the recruiters were talking about, they were using the FDA as sort of a, of course it's safe. You know, this is an FDA-approved study, which isn't really what it was an IRB-approved study. Not an FDA-approved study, but people hear FDA, and oh, okay. So there was framing in that way. There was sort of referencing the FDA as evidence of a trial safety. And what's even more interesting, if you can, phase two, which she observed as well, the dosing cohorts, for people that were being offered, and again, people weren't being told at what dose they were, but for people who were at the lower end, the recruiters talked about, it's such a low dose, such a low risk. You know, they were minimizing the risk, not really talking about benefits, just minimizing risk. But when they got to the higher doses, they flipped and started telling potential recruitees about the higher benefit of the higher dose. Not that it was a higher risk, that it had the potential for a higher benefit. So they never said, low risk, really low benefit. I mean, we just have to kind of go through you to get to the higher doses. I think that is fascinating. You know, so there's so, the research ethics in the United States is really centered around this act of informed consent and how we treat patients, subjects. And I bring it up here because it's gonna, how then do we talk about informed consent, noise, therapeutic misconception of patients and providers in an international context? Okay, so I've broken this down, and I guess I could give, here, you know, if you're here, I want to start with informed consent. And the people who wrote about informed consent, Carolyn, Wendy, Hatem, and Elizabeth. Placebo-based standard, I want to start with Andy, Wendy, Hamid A, and Katrina. Sponsor-host relations, Pepe talked about that. I want him to start our discussion. And then Angel's questions, Jane and Allie posted about that. So let me back up. Okay. Carolyn, are you here?
Yeah.
Yes. Can you start us off with, kudos for being my first guinea pig on this. In terms of how does the question of informed consent, what else do we need to think about? How does our conversation change? How does our ethical analysis change when we talk about informed consent in an international setting?
I think language is the first thing that pops into my mind. Mm-hmm. I think, I forget which article talked about how they're not using the correct phrasing in translating, mm-hmm. that, you know, they have different meanings than what the actual informed consent is in English versus whatever language they're translating to, and then, you know, are they actually then being informed of what the procedure, what the process actually is? Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing that pops into my mind when thinking about it in a, you know, multi, you know, national type of thing.
Okay. Thank you. What else? What else comes with informed consent? Eva?
Oftentimes literacy or some sort of documentation.
Right.
I mean, definitely mm-hmm. not always. And mm-hmm. I guess now, like one of the articles this week was talking about like videotaping consent.
Mm-hmm. So. Oh yeah, using flashcards, using drawings, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess making sure that not only is in an international setting, not only that it's translated, but that the participant actually understands, so that they actually get what the study's about, the rest mm-hmm. of the stuff like that.
Yeah, this happens on two levels, is what I'm thinking. It's not just the immediate level of, this is the study I'm being presented with, but it's also just, although in some communities now in parts of Africa, people, oh, it's a clinical trial, of course, they know now what it means. But for many people who are in situations without access to, you know, a lot of international news or communications or healthcare, the idea that there would be something, a clinical trial, even the idea of a clinical trial needs to be translated. It's not just, here's what we want to study, and here's what we're here to do. It's also, here's this thing that these global pharmaceutical companies do. Here's what it's all about. So I think informed consent, in this is one of those cases where it really doesn't work to take a U.S. model and just pick it up and move it. Because more people here have an understanding of, I mean, you see it advertised on buses. You know, interested in quitting smoking? Overweight with diabetes? Under 35? You know, clinical trial that could help you. You know, so that's another sort of interesting study to do, sort of the how clinical trials are advertised. And informed consent, what's another key issue then with informed consent? Above and beyond just the do you understand what we're doing, and specifically, and do you understand the point of a clinical trial? What are some other issues with informed consent that come in an international setting more so than come here? Or perhaps differently? I mean, we kind of already given it away in terms of the parent of the kid with terminal cancer.
There's a little bit more of an element of coercion. I mean, if your option is going to the clinical trial or don't get any treatment at all or like have very minimal treatment, like, okay, well, then I'll be in the clinical trial. And then you also have people that, and I mean, I've seen this even in the U.S. where, like, you know, we have a better understanding of, like, clinical care versus research care, but if you don't understand that difference, it's a question of, like, mm-hmm. are you also being coerced just thinking that you're getting treatment?
Mm-hmm. Right, because if you don't know that there's alternative care available. Mm-hmm. I think I have this on a later slide.
Also, when you have infant consent, you want to have conversation that there is a risk of failure of what we are doing. It does not necessarily mean that what we are doing for you is going to be successful 100%. Mm-hmm. There is a chance of failure. Because always the patient expectation is this will work. Mm-hmm. But not most of the time.
Right.
Due to uncertain reason for that period. I'm a dentist, so always we have informed consent every day we go to the patients. One of the main things that have to be highlighted for the patient that the treatment might not work due to bad oral hygiene or bad, for example, implants might lose. We lose the implant. The implant is 95% successful, but mm-hmm. still there is a chance of 5% to lose the implant.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and that gets to really, particularly in a resource poor setting, the difference between patient and subject. You know, you're right. Patients are perhaps less able to hear this is a test or it has a failure rate. Whereas that's really the key message that needs to be imparted to a subject. But if you're a patient and a subject, which, you know, the lack of international regulations, there's a handful of international guidelines. And there was only one that I found. Because I wanted to talk about recourse. Yeah, I got the Nuremberg Code, the Delaware Code, and Helsinki. And they all talk about sort of rights of the subjects, you know, not to be experimented against, to be fully informed, blah, blah, blah. The only one that I could find, and I sent out an email to a couple people and they haven't gotten back to me to see if I'm missing anything, the Council for International Organizations of Medical Sciences is the only set of regulations that I, or not, or recommendations that I found that included an obligation to provide healthcare services. So I'm wondering, you know, to what extent are international clinical trials have incorporated within them treatment, which further confounds the informed consent treatment subject barrier. Does it become hopelessly muddled? I don't know. All right, so, 10 to 6, okay. There's our overview of informed consent issues. This is one that a lot of people talked about. And Andy, given that you're sort of our resident expert in legal pharmaceutical issues, well, you have the most experience. I appreciated your post on this topic, and I was hoping you could start us out in this part of the discussion, sort of summarizing what you had posted.
Well, to the extent that I can remember, Marcia Angel is a bit of a terrorist as far as pharmaceutical companies are concerned. And she takes a pretty extreme position in her article, and I think she says that she's very critical of placebo-controlled studies. The point in the maternal infant HIV transmission studies that were done in Africa is that they used placebo-controlled studies. It was financed by the federal government, by the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health. And the governments, not the pharmaceutical companies, but the government's rationale for doing placebo-controlled studies is that in the environment where the studies are being done, there were several rationales. One is, which Paul Farmer wouldn't go for, it was just the expense of having to bring people in for the existing treatment, for the standard. It requires constant follow-up. It's very expensive. It requires all sorts of infrastructure that might not exist. But more importantly, it's that this is a population that's suffering from lots of other diseases and being treated perhaps with lots of other substances or medications. And that you're not getting an apples-to-apples comparison when if you use the standard treatment. Using a placebo really does tell you whether your medicine is efficacious. Mm-hmm. And using the standard medication with people who may have two or three other serious underlying diseases and lots of other medications, confounding the study might not really give you a fair comparison. And there are times to do placebo-controlled studies. And I think the FDA in lots of circumstances requires drug companies to do placebo-controlled studies even when standard treatments do exist. But they had very good justification in these studies that they did with the HIV infections, and Marcia Angel does not, in her piece, just ignores their justifications for it.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not, certainly not driven by profit in that case.
Right. I mean, I think what's interesting when you go into that line of argument, you can kind of flip around and say, in a case like maternal infant HIV transmission, in incredibly resource poor settings, if you can more quickly, more accurately, I guess those are the two biggies, determine that a short course, a novel short course of treatment to prevent maternal infant transmission of HIV, that's actually more ethical than muddying it and complicating it with, like you say, bringing in the entire infrastructure to give US-based standard of treatment to a population where if you can show that the short course works more quickly, you can get that treatment out faster and end up helping more people. Because my gut reaction, whenever I hear these sorts of studies, I'm like, you know, that's ridiculous. Why would you placebo-controlled trial? Then you stop and think about it, because our gut reaction is, it's not fair. And I don't like, well, I won't say that. Other thoughts? Yeah, Jane.
Well, I feel like there are a lot of placebo-controlled studies that also have like the caveat that like after a certain amount of time, you're automatically going to get the treatment. And these tend to be sort of later stage studies or later phase studies where, you know, the drug's already been approved to a certain point, but they still want to be able to have that quick efficacy sort of like look at it, does it work? And written into the consent, it's usually like, okay, well, if you do this, at the end of the study, you're going to be given the drug, or like, mm-hmm. the last half of the study.
They break the blind.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And I think maybe one of the issues is just that they're using these populations because they don't have a standard, so it's just easier to test the people. And it's not there. I mean, like, and so then it goes into, are we testing people who are going to benefit in the long run from this treatment? Mm-hmm. So then we're getting data on people who are ever going to see the fruits of the research.
Mm-hmm. A complementary issue to that is, and Andy, you brought this up, a big criticism of a lot of international trials is that the recruiting is not as sort of stringent. Like, you know, we'll see the Trovan case, they said, you know, they didn't do, because they were also in sort of a crisis mode, they didn't do initial blood tests, they didn't do initial workups. There's no underlying sort of health status of these research participants. So it begs the question, how good is our data? You know, if the idea of clinical trials is you start with normal volunteers, you work up to mildly symptomatic, you get sort of disease population, you know, you sort of really isolated who you think this is going to work for. And you're also primarily, perhaps, how's that for equivocating? Dealing with a population that has a general higher standard of health, other than the health issue in question. Then if you're dealing with a population that didn't have a lot of access to health care, may have many underlying health problems that we don't know about. You know, malnutrition, who know, well, people know, but who knows how that affects, you know, drug absorption, drug response, all these sorts of things. So then the question becomes, are we really just, this is where the constant gardener, you know, the sort of a constant garden of natural resources that we can cycle through, just really because our ultimate goal is that hothouse tomato, which is a blockbuster drug in the United States.
You always have a selection criteria for the subjects, right? For the studies.
In international settings? Or, wait.
Yes.
Right, there are selection criteria. Yes. So, what did I say that made you say that?
Like, we know, like, if they're malnourished, the drug absorption will be less, so we always keep those things in mind. Mm. So, according to those things, we make our selection criteria. We exclude those patients from the study.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm sorry, are you involved in clinical trials?
Not really.
Oh, okay. It just, you sound like you're speaking from authority, and I was going to hope to pull more data out of you. True, but one of the other issues, though, is sort of the outsourcing of clinical trials. Some of the articles for this week, you know, whether or not she's a terrorist or not, I think, you know, that there have been more than a handful of occasions with international clinical trials where once the data is audited, it doesn't hold up. It's sloppy, it's not consistent, and a lot of that probably has to do with how do you keep track of people, like when Francis says, when you don't even know what a home is, you know, how do you keep track of people? So I think
that's not a problem just in international trials. I mean, the BIACS example is one of domestic trials where you could argue that the company hid the data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
Or was sloppy.
I think this though leads us nicely, though, to where what Pepe's comment on the discussion board was in terms of, you know, if we're moving clinical trials to in an international setting, more important becomes the sponsor-host relations. You know, so that if you, you know, you need experts on the ground for multiple reasons. You know, for the informed consent process, for the recruitment of patients, for the tracking of patients, for all the things that, you know, we can do here, but because we all share a certain culture, we have a general idea of how to do it, whether or not we hide it or we're sloppy about it. We have a general idea of what we're supposed to be doing. And one of the articles talks about, and then I'll turn it over to you, Pepe, that one way to think about it is we need to move away from a contents-based protocol, that we're not just outlining what has to happen when we move internationally. We need to move to procedure-based negotiations. So moving from the what to the how, which we've been talking about throughout the semester. And if you want to move the question to how in international research studies, sponsor-host relations have to play a greater role. And can I now point to you? Because you had a good post about sponsor-host, or you posed a question about sponsor-host relations.
Well, my question was basically, assuming that benefit sharing is something that should be done, if you get somebody to be in a clinical trial, and assuming that you have like an obligation to retribute the participation of this person, even though there's still no consensus, some say that the retribution should be monetary compensation for travel and your time, or should it be something more solidarity, something like, okay, we are going to this community, we're going to have a clinical trial, and we're going to put a hospital. So I was just thinking how going and having clinical trials abroad in that scenario, if the sponsors of a clinical trial wanted to make a retribution, wouldn't it be more significant to do something that would help alleviate the community health in that host community? Mm-hmm. So it was something like that. And I was thinking, okay, instead of just giving money for time and just, I don't know, if you see that there's a problem of cholera, make something like a water treatment mm-hmm. plant. Mm-hmm. So it was something like that, the idea I had.
Yeah, that's actually, when Andy was talking about the rationale that the CDC gives is that they have a whole host of other things going on and a whole host of other medications that they might have. I thought, well, and if you're not going to give them placebo, give them something else that could help them that's maybe not going to interact. Or hopefully not going to interact, assuming you can know that.
Other thoughts?
It's also, I forget who mentioned it, whether it was our guest speaker or it was you, but I remember reading it. I actually ended up reading, not your Zhao Biel article, but one earlier about...
I apologize for that. Someone was like, oh my God, his work is amazing. And I was like, okay, fine. And then I read it. I was like, ooh, no.
But in it was his book, I read like a chapter of it at some point. He talks about how this wasn't for a trial, but for treatment, AIDS treatment.
Mm-hmm.
They also gave food baskets to, I guess it was like entice people to come get the treatment, to kind of combat the stigma, like
mm-hmm.
to reveal yourself as an AIDS patient.
Mm-hmm. This is treatment though, not research.
This is yeah. not research, okay. But just that it was
because otherwise we're coercing people.
No, but it was sponsored host relate. That's what was relevant mm-hmm. about it. It was that the group coming in worked with the local government in local, they called them casas, and they came together and thought of a solution. And I think it was our guest speaker who was like, the reason they did that was because you need to take the treatment with food.
Mm-hmm.
And so you give the basket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that was working together. I thought that was kind of...
Yeah. It's exactly. It's one of those things that I think I mentioned a couple weeks ago, that, and I just learned this, you know, that 30% of discharge orders from Temple University Hospital, which is sort of the go-to hospital for the uninsured, cannot be complied with because the discharge orders assume running water and other amenities of a house. So if you don't have those things. So it's the idea that there are aspects to communities that we're not even aware of unless you have a representative from the community or you've got really good ethnographic data, you know, to following people from the emergency room, you know, following their path through the healthcare system. Where are those disconnects? Where are the barriers? Yeah, so that's something that, you know, could that be done on a U.S. scale? You know, if you're talking about doing a clinical trial on a disease that primarily affects Latinos, do you want to work with, you know, Latino organizations in the cities that you're working with to say, you know, what does this community need? So a lot of these, I think what's interesting is which ones can then come back to the U.S. We start at the U.S., we look overseas, which ones can come back. And then there's the questions which Jane and Allie talked about in their postings, which were from Angel's questions, key ethical questions are, is it possible to do this research in the first world? And if it is, then why is it being diverted to poor countries? Sort of as key questions. And Jane, can I call on you to throw your two cents into the hat on this one?
Well, I was talking a little bit about, I think it was the Body Hunters article that was basically saying, like, the only time you should be doing research or fraud is if it's, like, specific, like, the disease is specific
right.
to that country or that region. And I don't, like, while I might agree with that, I don't know that she makes a good enough argument for that, and I think the problem is, I mean, one of the big issues is they say that it's, like, and we talked a little bit about standard of care before and whether or not that comes into play with the placebo control stuff. And I think a lot of these places you don't really, you know, the standard of care might not be treatment or it'll be a lesser treatment. So it's a question of, you know, are we okay with them going doing research there and giving placebo, knowing that it's not going to be as helpful for everyone, but so that some people are getting treatment. Like, that's one side of it. Another is that... kind of on the flip side, like, if you're going to do this and get, you know, get this drug out of whatever trial this is, what happens if you're taking advantage of this population because they're not going to be able to afford it in the long run? I thought that was, like, the strongest argument that was made in favor of not doing research in developing countries is that, you know, if they're not going to benefit from it, you probably shouldn't be doing research there. That, I think that was the one that really stuck with me personally.
Do you want to chime in?
I was just bothered by the picture that was painted in the Body Hunters article that these poor people are, like, so desperate and sick, and, you know, we come in there and we basically use them as guinea pigs and then leave, and then at the end of the day they're not even able to really benefit from the drugs that could potentially have helped them.
Mm-hmm. Could the same thing be said for the vast majority of research participants in the United States? at least in terms of, like, you know, the phase 2-y kind of people, or even 3.
Well, I mean, my big problem with a lot of the arguments that were made were that there are arguments that are valid, but it's not a reason for why research shouldn't be done in an international setting. I think it's for why we need to improve the way we do research. I mean, I've been involved in a number of the clinical trials as a coordinator, and regularly you have it where the patients don't know if it's their clinical care, if it's their, you know, research care. You know, they get mixed up over the procedures. There's regularly issues with consent and them, you know, agreeing to something, but, you know, then having, you know, the PIs be like, well, no, like, just go ahead and push in, like, you know, they want to have that test, it's fine. And, like, I see that here, I think that those sorts of issues that, you know, they talk about as being a big problem internationally are just as big of a problem here. But, you know, so in that way, I don't think those arguments should be made for the why it shouldn't be international.
Yeah.
A little randomly.
No, I feel like I probably missed some points, so if I say anything, it's been just cut me off. But yeah, I guess in terms of this country, like, we do offer, first of all, yeah, it's not oftentimes people that are in the trials that are benefiting from the trials themselves, but we do offer incentives, like you were mentioning, whether or not it's like getting, you know, high deductibles paid for as like very minimal. And so, how much of that is kind of to your point of whether or not it would be worse off or not. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting.
No, it's all contributing to the picture. Wendy.
Well, just from a cost standpoint too, like, I wonder if the drug companies just aren't willing to, as our standard here would cost money. Like, you know, you'd have to legally, you know, provide the current standard, and that would cost me way, way more than nothing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if they're not able to, you know, like, you just think about how much money is involved in this whole process and involved in, like, drug companies in general. And is it that it's not possible, or they just don't want to? Like, I don't know.
Great. Clues to that, you know, sort of looking at, you know, and again, sort of we're leading up to this sort of Trovan case, which is really where the body hunters is all talking about. Vulnerable populations have been exploited right and left in clinical research. One sort of, it was a little extremist. The blog had a lot of examples. The only one that sort of held up was this homeless people die after bird flu vaccine trial in Poland. And that's in 2008. It was a homeless shelter. And they, because you have such a vulnerable population, easily exploitable, told them that they were getting a flu vaccine, but it was actually an avian flu trial. So it was testing a new type of vaccine. And again, do people die in clinical trials? Yes. You know, do people die of diseases? Yes, all the time. You know, so it's more of a question of the practice of research, which is where Jane is sort of going. You know, we got the Guatemalan case that just came out, Tuskegee. You know, which isn't, it's sort of developing world within the developed world. So again, these are all sort of pieces of the puzzle to try and figure out why this system works the way it does. We've been talking for a while. I want to put some pictures to our story. Whoops, that's not what I meant to do. There it is. This is a, how long is it? 15 minutes. I got this from John Mers. I don't know where it came from. I can't figure it out, but Dying for Drugs, and you can tell by the music and the tone, you know, it very well may be produced by someone who wrote, you know, the Body Hunters type of book. It tells the same story, but it gives us different words, different people. I think it adds to the readings. What I'd like to do is watch it. If we find that we're getting bored, we can stop it a little bit early. And don't jump up and leave, because I want to end with this international legal recourse, you know, because that's the question, sort of, where are the regulations? Why aren't they being enforced? And so we'll continue where this video leaves off with some of the trials that have been attempted, or the suits that have been brought, the complaints that have been brought in relation to Trovan, both here and in Nigeria. Okay. And I can't get any bigger, that's just what it is. Well, a little bit bigger, but then it gets fuzzy.
The initial steps in bringing a promising drug to market